Okay, members, we'll call this meeting to order of the Subcommittee on Elections. Seeing as how we have a quorum present, I'd like to first move the minutes or have Representative Bonner, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have. So moved.
Okay, we have a motion to move the minutes. So everyone in favor of moval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Seeing none, the minutes are approved. And I would now like us to move to our first bill before us, House File 673. Representative Lucero, I will move your bill before us. It would be laid over for possible inclusion. So if you could present your bill. And I believe we may at some point have some testifiers, and I believe that an individual from the Campaign Finance Board is here if there's any questions. So please proceed.
Perfect. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. So I have the bill, and I also have an amendment. But I'll just speak on a little bit of background on the motivation for the bill. So this last year, there was an advisory opinion that was published by the Campaign Finance Board, and it was in relation to this topic, which gave the opinion that current law does not permit campaigns to reimburse for the cost of security, and both physical security and identity theft or cyber-related digital security. And so based on that, and based on the fact that we live in the information age where public officials and their information continues to be very readily available to the world. And we've seen recent examples in the last several years of those that unfortunately take the battle of ideas and go beyond the arena and do stuff that poses a risk to those who serve as public officials. And so what this bill seeks to do is based on the opinion of current law of the Campaign Finance Board, which I agree with the advisory opinion, current law does not permit that. So this would seek to allow that that those costs would be reimbursed or paid by the campaign. So what the amendment attempts to do is when I'm looking at the original language of the bill, it says while serving in office. And so that got me to thinking, well, the bill as written, the scope of that would only be for a person who has been elected. It wouldn't apply to those who are campaigning and perhaps are not elected officials, nor would it apply to their spouse. So that's what motivated me to try to come up with some additional language that seeks to expand the scope. So even if you're running for office and you're not an incumbent, so you're not a sitting public official, you would be allowed to use your campaign funds for security purposes. Then the question goes beyond that, which is, to what degree is reasonable? Is there a risk to the spouse, for example? Is there a risk to perhaps children who live under the same roof? And so that's where that language I have there. But I'm very interested in feedback, comments on how we can craft language if there's interest in this bill to draw that line at the appropriate place, the candidate, perhaps the spouse, and if there's a support for perhaps children under the same roof. So that's why I won't be offering the amendment, but that's I'm definitely interested in those conversations, and I admit that the language there may be too broad in its current form. So with that, Mr. Chair, I do have a letter. I did have a testifier who was intending to testify and give her personal experience as a public official where this would have been useful. And because she couldn't be here due to the snow, that's what that letter is. That's been passed around. So with that, Mr. Chair, I have no additional testifiers beyond that. So I'm willing to open up for questions.
Okay. Representative Lucero, when I look at the bill, it clearly places us under non-campaign disbursements.
Correct.
Members, questions?
And Mr. Chair, if you'd allow, so a non-campaign disbursement, as you see there in the briefs, we have limits, if you agree to the public subsidy, we have limits on what we can spend. A non-campaign disbursement doesn't count against, so it's for expenses that we incur, but it's not for the direct election or attempt to be elected. It's for other expenses, ancillary expenses, that don't count against that limit if they're not for the direct efforts of being elected or campaigning. And so that's the category this would fall in.
And yes, Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, I think you were going to make a comment before I read the
handle. No, I was just going to say thanks for adding the clarification.
Representative Lucero, I know that you and I talked about this well in the past. You talked about this idea last year. And when you serve in public office, particularly in the environment that we are now with social media and the things that are on there and what's on there, it's always on the internet. I think you bring up a very valid point that whether you're a candidate, whether you are incumbent on those, that there needs to be concern about that, because you may choose to run for office as well as not. Your family name may or may not be on board with those kinds of things. I think that is a good thing to strive to support that process as best we can, and most of the world is getting time. Then they don't want to be involved, isolated from that, and you can handle it with the comfort regarding that situation.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could add, as to the point of Rep. O'Driscoll, everything is online, much of the information is out there. And if you think about the different websites or areas that you go to, the security questions if you forgot your password, if you need to reset your password, what are some of the common questions? Your mother's maiden name, your high school mascot, other things like that, the childhood, the city you grew up in, the first name of your eldest sibling. Right? In this information age, much of this information can be found, where we graduated, the year we graduated, et cetera. So having identity theft protection, again, to that point, how it's out there and readily accessible.
Well, Representative Lucero, as I had mentioned, we're going to be laying this over. It seems that there might be some sort of space around what does this mean for an elected official versus what it means for a candidate, and I believe that before this gets incorporated, we can, if we need to, come back here and address that language to make sure that that's clear, that this does apply to candidates as well. Much of current campaign finance laws applies to candidates as well as elected officials, so I don't know if this is a big trick up by having it say elected officials, but we will work with the campaign finance board to make sure that language gets us to where we're intended. And Mr. Sergeson, if you could speak to that, how this might be impacted, and do we need to add some clear definition, the difference between elected official and a candidate in our campaign finance laws?
Mr. Chair, my name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the Executive Director with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Many of the non-campaign disbursements are available both to incumbents and candidates. Only costs of serving in office and constituent services are limited only to incumbents. So there wouldn't be anything in particular about that that would be that would necessarily be limited to an incumbent.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Bernard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question regarding if it were to be a candidate or even a legislator that didn't run for election again, if this was something of value, and usually you have to purchase something if you don't. I can't remember. What would be the, how would this be handled after you weren't a candidate anymore or after you weren't a legislator anymore? How would it be handled? You know what I'm talking about, the expenses? Yeah, okay, thanks.
Mr. Sergeson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, to avoid a conversion to personal use when the committee terminates any asset that was purchased by the committee, whether it be under current statute a laptop or some other item that may have been purchased by the committee for campaign purposes or non-campaign purposes, then at that point has to be liquidated by the committee. That means either donating it to another, for example, a political party if you're talking about a laptop, or there is the option of the candidate purchasing the item if that's the case, and they would use fair market value for the purchase.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, this might be for Thank you. This might be to Representative Lucero. What would a fair market value for a system like this be when you might have it wired in the walls? You might, I'm just, technology changes so much. I mean, it just doesn't seem like it might have very much value at all for resale. Okay.
Mr. Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when it comes to computer equipment, so, and let's just say in the case of a camera system, maybe a DVR that's recording it for backup, things like that, that I would put that as closely related to network or computer equipment. And if we were to use as guidance, I would go off maybe the federal guideline for depreciation. And if my memory serves, it's either 3 or 5 years. I think it's 3 years for a depreciation schedule for a laptop, for example. So I would say this would be about that same category. And so the fair market value, I think, would be significantly impacted, depending on how many years it's gone by, for its depreciation.
Thank you. So, Mr.
Representative
Chair, so in the end, it might not be any purchase because it's already depreciated. It has no value anymore.
Representative Lucero.
Or near zero, yeah.
Representative Nash, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question was for you. You said that this was going to be laid over.
Mm-hmm.
Are you intending to do an omnibus bill out of our committee and run that up through government operations?
I am intending to do that, Representative. And my understanding is, since government operations doesn't really do an omnibus type bill, that this would go to state government finance.
Okay. Very good. And then to follow up on that, Mr. Chair, is it your intent, as the governor has expressed, I believe, in an interview with Brianna Biersbach, that he intends to see all elections bills be bipartisan? Are we going to be building the bill in such a way to honor that requirement?
Representative Nash, as we have discussed previously, and as I think I've discussed very publicly, that we currently have a legislature, that the Senate is a GOP majority and that the House is a DFL majority. So any bill that would make it to the governor would have to go through what I would consider as a bipartisan process to make it to the governor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll bring that up again later, I'm sure.
Okay, well, that's certainly a prerogative. Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Lucero? Yes, Representative Bonner.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Lucero. I guess I'm just trying to understand how this would work. Certainly I understand there's an increased level of scrutiny as a candidate, and I appreciate that, having been through it myself, of course. But I guess I'm trying to understand how we apply some of these dollars to someone who is not the candidate, particularly because the funds that we're talking about using here are donated expressly to the candidate and the candidate's campaign committee specifically for the election of that candidate. And I guess this feels a little bit like it's usurping the will of those folks who donated the money. And so I guess I'm having a little bit of a concern around that. And I'm curious your thoughts on that. And I guess I'm just concerned that that might not be the will of the folks who donated the money.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what the representative is referring is my amendment, correct? Because I'm going to make sure I'm clarifying, because the language as written is narrow in scope to just an incumbent, actually. Correct. So you're not concerned about the current language?
I'm not concerned about the incumbent.
The amendment, okay.
Yes.
So to address that, very reasonable, and I agree with that. So that's where I'm looking for this committee to come up. Where do we draw the line of reasonableness? We start with the incumbent. Do we expand it? Is it reasonable to go to candidates? Do they sustain a certain level of risk? And if the answer is yes, then the next, I think, logical question is, spouse under the same, current spouse, what level of risk do they have to having their identity stolen or being the target of somebody wishing to do them cyber harm, for example? And I would say that the risk is certainly lesser in each of these steps. And if the answer is yes to a spouse, well, then, in my opinion, the next logical question would be, how about anybody else under that household? Are they also a potential target, and could they become the victim of identity theft? And so where do we draw that line of reasonableness? So in my opinion, I would say let's start with incumbents and candidates. And I think I would be okay with, if we have to draw the line there, so be it. But I think it's worth a healthy discussion should that line be drawn a little bit more. And I agree with you, though, on your point.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Any other questions? Okay, House File 673 will be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next up on the agenda, and I don't know if this microphone is going out into the ether, but Representative Gomez has House File 797 up. So we will wait for notice to be made to her and for her to step in here really quick. Representative Gomez, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry for being out in the hallway. There's so much enthusiasm about elections today.
Yes, well, it's an exciting day in our committee. So we have House File 979. Representative Bernardi, would you move?
Sure.
House 979 for the possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to move House File 979 for possible inclusion into the elections omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. Representative Gomez, again, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and
sure.
We will proceed with your testimony. I know you have a few other testifiers, and I'll look to you to cue to when then bring them up.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I am happy to have House File 979 in front of you today. It directs the Secretary of State to prepare materials that will assist tenants in registering and finding their polling locations. And it requires that landlords provide a copy of these materials to tenants upon entering into a lease, within 30 days of entering into a lease. So, you know, registration, of course, is the first step in participating in elections. And when you move, you have to update your registration. So, you know, of course, for people who are renting, tenants who move around a lot, they might have to change their registration a number of times. This is just a low-cost option to help renters kind of overcome that potential barrier. You know, renters are more likely to have their registrations lapse than other folks. This bill will impact young people and lower-income people disproportionately because that's who rents housing. Minneapolis implemented this. I think it went into effect on March 1st, 2016, and they kind of have a really streamlined system. When you go and on the sort of checklist when you're applying for a license to rent a house out, it's just one of the items that you have to take care of. There's sort of a few things you have to hand your tenant. It's just another piece of paper that you have to give them. So I have a testifier here who's a landlord from Minneapolis who's been doing this for the last few years. Jana Flissman, if you want to come up.
Yeah, Representative Gomez,
sorry.
Before we get into your testifiers, there are a few amendments.
Yes.
So I would like to take care of them, and then we'll have
okay.
the testifier speak. So the first amendment is A1. Who is offering that?
Mr. Chair, I'll offer the A1.
Okay. Speak to your amendment.
Yeah, Mr. Chair,
Representative Nash.
Thank you for this, and members. This is to enable landlords to make this a permissive activity instead of a prescriptive activity. It's pretty straightforward, so I mean, it's not something that I would view as hotly contested. But, you know, when you require a landlord to do something and you essentially say this is under penalty of law and there are fines if you choose not to do this, I just think that making it permissive is a little more Minnesota nice, a little more friendly. So I would urge this adoption.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Gomez, would you like to speak to the A1 amendment?
Yeah, I would ask members not to support this amendment. I think that Making it an opt-in means that people probably won't do it. So I actually want tenants to get the information. Ask folks not to support it.
And Mr. Chair, if I could.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly believe in voter participation. I think we all do. Minnesota mm-hmm. is one of the highest in the country. But I think, again, requiring landlords who are already taking on a lot to do this, and at the time of contract signing and all that, I think you just said that it's yet another piece of paper. I think that making it permissive is a little bit easier so that they don't have to do it necessarily at the time of signing. And again, I'm just trying to make this the whole Minnesota nice approach. You know, we talk about one Minnesota here. I think that's been a big catchphrase as of late. And making something that is permissive and has penalties along with it doesn't strike me that way at all. So, members, I would urge this adoption. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Nash. I would like to move through the amendments because we have another bill up yet tonight. So all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say nay.
Nay. Nay.
Okay. Being lack of majority, this amendment fails. There's another amendment before us, the A2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, that's mine.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, again, anticipating that Representative Gomez would not like my Minnesota Nice amendment, I am making it perhaps a little easier to make it so that they just have to post this information in a centralized place. And having lived in an apartment many, many, many years ago, you frequent certain places, mailboxes, laundry rooms, different places like that. Again, trying to be Minnesota Nice, I think that this would be a good step in that right direction and would urge its adoption.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Gomez, would you like to speak to the A2 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this, I guess in Minneapolis, it presents a little bit of a logistical problem, kind of like there are a number of requirements in terms of posting. So you have to put up a 311 poster, a tenants rights resource poster, and you have to post your license in a place kind of in the foyer, you know. So I'm not sure how they deal with some of those issues in other municipalities, but I think that, you know, it's not, it's no, I don't see how it's a significantly less of a burden to provide the information directly to the tenant when you enter into a lease with them. So I would urge members not to support this amendment.
Representative Nash, do you have a comment?
Well, I
understand.
There's
a few more amendments as well.
There are. So we'll let this one go for now, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Okay, we will vote on the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Nay. The amendment fails due to lack of a majority. The A3 amendment.
Sorry.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I would move the A3 amendment.
Okay. Representative Noon, please speak to your amendment.
Excellent. On line 16, it says that the landlord must provide, and I would suggest, you know, the landlord has to make this information available. And then on line 20, I would just add after the period, the information may be made available electronically. Similar to what Representative Nash just brought up, this could become quite cumbersome, especially if there are multi-units. I mean, there are landlords who have, you know, literally hundreds of units, and they really could have quite a bit of turnover, and this could create a significant liability and a significant cost, and it's really easy to make that information available electronically at this point.
Thank you, Representative New. Representative Gomez, would you like to speak to this amendment?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative New. I actually wanted to have a chance to chat with you a little bit about this because I think that we can rework this, I think, in a way that I would be comfortable with, just because as I'm reading it, like the combination of changing from provide to make available to, with the information may be made available to a tenant electronically, to me indicates that you could like have a link on a property management company's website, for example, that would be make available to electronically. I think if there was again, like sort of a more kind of affirmative approach, like sending it via email to a tenant, I would be fine with that. That's how we do it in Minneapolis, and I think that's totally reasonable. And then it kind of takes out the issue about the, you know, like penny and a half that you might spend printing out a piece of paper that had the information, and instead you could just kind of send an email to a tenant. I would be happy with that, but as it's written here, I worry about the combination of the two changes. So if I don't know if there's a way to rework it, or if we could kind of work offline to collaborate on something we could both agree on. In its current form, I'm not supportive of it, but I think the option of sending something via email is totally reasonable in 2019.
And Representative Gomez and Representative New, as this will become back before us as part of a larger omnibus bill, we do have the opportunity to do that. So I would encourage you both to sort of figure out what that language would do that would satisfy not only your concern about it could just be a random thing on a website, but also a notion of what does that direct contact mean with that tenant or that prospective tenant.
Sure. Representative? Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Gomez, I appreciate that. I guess my question, I would ask to the larger bill, but it goes along with this amendment because I think it's relevant. So this is very specific to landlords. Can I ask why you are singling out landlords as opposed to realtors or title companies or something along these lines when someone is purchasing a home? You know, why would we just single out landlords for this? And especially, you know, and how are we going to hold them accountable to this? I just think this is rather selective, putting a regulation on one group that it doesn't necessarily make sense to single out that one group. Certainly we want voter participation across the board. Mm-hmm. And as Representative Nash said, we're pretty lucky that we get to boast the highest voter participation in the entire country. I'm curious as to why that would be.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for your question. So like a landlord renting a home to somebody is an activity that's licensed by local municipalities, and so there's this really strong kind of point of contact where, you know, like a city issues a license to a landlord in a way that a city is not involved in, as far as I understand. And I've never bought a house, so you'll have to excuse me if I don't understand the process of, you know, a kind of transaction between two private individuals, such as would happen in a title transfer or like when you're interacting with a realtor when you're buying a house. But to me, there's you know, this is a point where you know, as government, we are licensing an activity, and so again, it's sort of this contact point, and this bill would take advantage of that to increase information for folks who may otherwise not have may otherwise face barriers to you know, getting that information.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So so you mentioned that this is a point at which cities would interact and that they would have some oversight here. So I guess I would ask, at least I assume, perhaps I'm wrong, but I assume that the state actually also regulates real estate transactions and title companies. I guess I could be wrong on that, but I'd be shocked. So I guess my question would be then, why are we taking, if you're saying that this is a relationship between the city and landlords, why would we be doing this at the state level? Why would we not leave that to local municipalities?
Representative Gomez.
Because in the state of Minnesota, the Secretary of State's office is responsible for administering elections, and so I think this is an appropriate function of the Secretary of State. We may disagree about that, but I can't really speak to your point about the regulation of title companies and realtors again. I'm sorry, I can't really comment on that. But.
Yes, Representative Doom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I feel like there's some inconsistencies in the bill that I'd be very concerned about. And I would just be very concerned about those inconsistencies. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liu. And Representative Gomez, buying a house is much, much more laborious than renting, renting an apartment or a home from a landlord.
So I've heard.
So we will vote on A3. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. No?
No.
The motion fails due to lack of majority, the amendment. Amendment 4.
Mr. Chair, that'll be me.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, so, Mr. Chair, we've heard Representative Gomez talk about the requirements that will be labeled on top of business owners who are going to be now having to do this if this bill were to become law. And yet we've not heard of any consideration for those landlords who are going to have to administer this. They may have to hire someone and expend extra resources. They may have to take part of their day from other activities, other gainful employment, and go and do this this administration of this stuff. And it seems to me that you're creating an unfunded mandate on these landowners or these landlords. So I think that it's not inappropriate to suggest and to create, and I hate even saying this, a blank appropriation. I think that Ronald Reagan may turn in his grave. But Representative
Gomez,
we're
okay with that, Representative.
What's that?
We're okay with.
Well, that side, yes. This side, less. But Representative Gomez, I think you realize that this is going to take effort and money. And if they are, let's say, they own an apartment in Fridley, but they live in my district of Waconia, and now they have to go do this, they're going to have all these expenses to get this done, and you've not afforded anything for that. So. You've now really put the burden on individual people who may, as an investment, buy an apartment building. Or at a larger level, we've got folks that own multiple properties, and now you're going to create a situation where they may have to hire a whole new person or people to handle just this one activity that you're asking us to vote on. So I would offer the A4, Mr. Chair, and I would ask for a roll call on this. Again, this is, I think your intent is, I'm sure you believe very strongly in this, but there are financial ramifications of this that you have not considered at all. And as somebody who has many landlords in my district, and some of them are personal friends, I ran this past them, and they said, Jim, if this becomes law, I'm going to see a whole new level of expenses that I've got no way to recoup. And that's fundamentally unfair. And I believe that is not what we would call one Minnesota or Minnesotan at all. I think your intent, you believe that it's a good thing to do, but you're now sticking it to landlords all over the state of Minnesota. So I think that you should compensate them for that if your bill is to become law. So.
Thank you, Representative Nash. And before I'll let Representative Gomez, I'll just respond that we're not going to assume that someone that's introduced a bill hasn't considered some things. Your statement about she has not considered,
I
think is a little bit too far. So, Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash, for the question and for the amendment. So, you know, I guess I am interested. Can I ask a question of the representative? No, not so much? Okay, cool. I won't ask you a question then. Because of course I thought, you know, to the chair's point, of course I thought about what it would take to, you know, to download a single piece of, you know, maybe like a one-page PDF. I think you could probably fit the information that you need in this bill, download that onto your computer, and either print it off or, you know, if the representative now and I can come to some terms, maybe just like email it over, right? And, I mean, a piece of paper costs a cent. I know toner is really expensive. I think we can all kind of relate to that. But I guess I don't see this as a huge burden. And I mean, there are costs of doing business, and I guess, like, I'm trying to imagine a scenario in which you would have to hire a new employee to comply with this provision, and I'm just not seeing it, frankly. And so I guess, you know, as a renter, like, I actually, a lot of things that are costs of doing business get passed on to me, and so, you know, as a business owner, as a landlord, like, you can make that that decision to add the couple cents to the rent, you know, in the aggregate. I think it wouldn't be a lot. Also, I just want to say, like, this isn't, you know, I'm not trying to beat up on landlords. I appreciate landlords. That's why I have a place to live, is because I have a great landlord. You know, it's not to try to make it so that it's difficult to own and rent property in Minnesota. That's certainly not the intent of this. And I don't think that we agree on the sort of premise that this creates an undue burden. You know, the other thing is that I just am wondering if you spoke to the Secretary of State about this, since it asks to appropriate money to them to do, you know, reimbursing costs incurred by a landlord. I'm just wondering what the process for that would be. What would the paperwork look like? What would the kind of reimbursement cost be? What would the cost to the Secretary of State's office be? So I don't know if you've had those conversations, but those are questions that I have reading this.
Representative Gomez, I believe we have someone from the Secretary of State's office, but before we go into that, Representative New had a question, so yeah. I'd like to recognize her.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was just going to reiterate, I heard discussion about the cost of the landlords in this, which certainly is a concern, but just a comment. I think the really critical piece of this is not necessarily the cost of the landlords, but that because the landlords won't absorb this cost. This is about costs to renters, and I think that that's what we really want to be concerned about here, is to make sure that we are not passing on additional costs to renters. We have a housing crisis in the state of Minnesota. We have an exorbitant cost of housing in the state of Minnesota, and I think we want to be really cautious about passing on additional costs there.
Thank you, Representative New. And before I have Sam Bonowitz come forward, I'm going to turn it over to Representative Nash.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative New made my point before I was going to make it, so thank you. But nothing is usually absorbed by the landlord. Let's talk about the scale of some of these properties. There are companies that own literally thousands of apartments. And now, because you've created a law that's going to require, because you chose not to take my permissive language, we are now looking at potential enforcement issues. So now a landlord is going to have to keep records for themselves, and they're going to have compliance issues, or perhaps you're going to move towards having some audit features put into this to make sure that they're doing this. So you've now created a situation for landlords who are going to have to create a whole new system of making sure that if your bill becomes law, that they are in compliance with it. All those things have cost, all of them. And to Representative New's point before I made it was, that'll get passed on to folks like yourself who are renting an apartment. So you're creating a situation where you're actually increasing your own costs. And I've never wanted to do that to myself. I would urge caution on this, because you are going to create a large amount of paperwork. Some folks, they're mom and pop landowner or landlords, and they've got maybe 20 units. But there are other people who have thousands of them. And I just think that this is going to be very unfair to their tenants, and that's going to create a giant burden for the companies that do make an investment to provide housing for people who need housing. And you've just complicated the issue when it could have been a permissive issue. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. And we have from the Secretary of State's office, Ms. Bonowitz, if you would speak to the position of the Secretary of State's office.
Yes, I am Sam Bonowitz. I'm Director of Government Relations. Chair, members of the committee, our office, the Secretary of State, is not supportive of this amendment. There would be a cost to administer these reimbursements. And there would also be a need to have some standards for these reimbursements, which this amendment doesn't include. So.
Thank you. Representative Nash, and then we're going to go to...
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, the representative from the Secretary of State's office has made my point for me that handling paper incurs cost, and the requirement to do this prescriptively will mandate the handling of paper, so it's going to add cost. So thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Bonowitz. And we will now move into a vote, seeing as a roll call vote has been called on the A4 amendment. Oh, are you fine? Okay. Clerk, take the roll.
Representative Dean?
No.
Representative Bonner?
No.
Representative Nash?
Yes.
Representative Bernardi?
No.
Representative Halverson is absent. Representative Mann? And Representative New?
Yes.
Representative
Ojisco? Yes. Okay. Being that there's three ayes and three nays, the amendment fails. The A5 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A5.
Okay. Speak to your motion, Representative New.
Sure, thank you. In the A5 amendment, so there are currently lawsuits have been filed. Minneapolis and St. Paul currently have an ordinance that this mimics. And there have already been lawsuits filed in both Minneapolis and St. Paul regarding this. And so this would be a blank appropriation to the Secretary of State's office for those costs that they will incur litigating this legislation, because surely this one will draw a lawsuit. Thank you.
Representative Gomez, to the A5 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I'm new around here, but I don't doing an appropriation in anticipation of a lawsuit seems like an unconventional approach to me. I don't know if that's normal, but I would encourage representatives not to support this amendment.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I would counter that with that's why it's a blank appropriation. If there is no lawsuit, it's $0, and that won't be an issue. But the Secretary of State's office is currently asking for an appropriation of $1 million to fight another lawsuit. So the potential costs of this are significant, and I think we need to be prepared that if we are going to pass legislation that is likely going to end up in litigation, we need to make sure that our agencies are prepared then to deal with that litigation.
Okay, thank you. So we will go to a vote on A5. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, nay.
Nay.
The A5 amendment fails due to lack of majority. And now we have the last amendment before us for House File 979, the A6 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the A6 amendment.
Okay, to your amendment, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, this is currently being litigated in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I guess I would just encourage, if we're not really sure about how this is going to go down, I would just encourage that we postpone the enactment date to following the judgment in that lawsuit.
Okay. Representative Gomez, to the A6 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the City of St. Paul is being sued over its ordinance, as is Minneapolis. St. Paul City Attorney said that the concern was mostly over the penalty, which is a petty misdemeanor, and that's not included in this bill. Just in general to the amendment, again, I guess I don't see the idea of us putting off enacting a piece of legislation pending litigation against a municipality, not even against the state of Minnesota, seems odd to me. And so I would urge people not to support this amendment.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You bring up an interesting point, Representative Gomez, and I would ask, is there no penalty for this law? I don't see it in the language. What are the consequences of not following this law for landlords?
Representative Gomez.
There are no penalties in the language.
So it's just a suggestion?
Representative Gomez.
It's in the law, so it's not a suggestion. We looked at the ordinances of Minneapolis and St. Paul in looking at this, and to Representative Nash's point, kind of introducing an accountability mechanism that would cost cities money was not something that we decided to include.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Gomez. I guess I would ask nonpartisan staff if they can give any clarification on that, on what really would happen then if landlords chose not to provide the information.
Mr. Gehring, if you could speak to her question.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, so there is a default penalty for sections of statute that don't have a specified penalty, and that is a penny misdemeanor. That's in Chapter 645. So if this law were violated, that default petty misdemeanor would likely apply.
Representative.
Thank you. And am I understanding correctly that is the subject of the lawsuit? Is that what you just said, Representative Gomez, that is actually the subject of the lawsuit for Minneapolis and St. Paul? Is the petty misdemeanor?
Representative Gomez.
That's based on a statement that the St. Paul city attorney made. Yeah, so
okay.
I haven't read the lawsuit, to be honest. It was filed last week, I think.
Representative, yeah.
Thank you, Chair Dean. So really, this really would be subject to the exact same litigation that's going on in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I would assume that the city or county attorney would be a good resource on that. So this really is subject to the exact same litigation if it really is over the exact same penalty. So I guess I would again encourage a yes vote on this amendment. If we vote yes on this, then we won't have to worry about the cost to the state of Minnesota to litigate this because it'll already have happened and there'll be precedent.
Representative Gomez, would you like to speak? I also have another question from Representative Nash. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Gehring brought some great information. Mr. Gehring, would you mind telling us the default penalty for that? What is the penalty? What is the potential fee around that? Because obviously, while we apparently moved on from a reasonable amendment, I think that bears a very good piece of information for the discussion around this whole bill. What would be the penalty be for ignoring this potential law were it to become law?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, so there's not a specified penalty amount in the default statute. It just provides as a petty misdemeanor, so it would be prosecuted according to the general standards that apply to petty misdemeanors.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gehring. And since we're at a point where we should vote on the A6 amendment, as we have some other bills coming up, all those in favor of the A6 amendments, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay.
Nay.
The motion fails due to lack of majority. So to your bill and to your testifiers, if you could please bring them forward.
Thank you. Yeah. Ms. Lister, do you want to come up?
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for having me and hearing this bill. My name is Yana Flissrand, and I am here because I am a landlord and I live in Minneapolis. My property is in Minneapolis, and I've been complying with that law for 2 years now. So I am a small mom-and-pop landlord, and something that I think is important about that is I have less capacity for complying with regulation because it's just me. I have a job, I have a life, I have to do the shoveling myself, and I have to make sure that everything that needs to be done in my house is being done. So I have less capacity for complying with regulations than a larger property owner that has typically hired management and staff who are dedicated to doing that. I have found that complying with this law in Minneapolis has been negligible and something that I haven't even noticed alongside the rest of my responsibilities as a landlord. So I'll talk a little bit about the process of leasing up an apartment, because I think that's very important. I have a standard kit, and leasing up an apartment is quite a bit of work. It's probably the single biggest thing that I do as a landlord. And at the time that we're doing the leasing, I have a packet of papers, and it's not huge, and adding one is not something that I even noticed, whether that's in terms of the time to download and print that material, or whether that's in terms of the time in the meeting with the tenant, or whether that's in terms of the materials for the printing. It is simply not an issue, because I just stuck it in my packet. Every time I'm leasing up an apartment, which typically happens 3 times a year, I print out that packet and I prep it alongside of the leases and everything else, and we just go through and sign that paperwork, and that's something that I leave with my tenants. I am already managing records for every single set of tenants and maintaining those over time, so this is not something that's been any sort of addition in terms of the volume of work that I'm doing there. I also do share the electronic notifications for how to register with my tenants, and that is also a very simple activity, because I need to have a system for communicating with all of my tenants about maintenance issues or other things that are happening in the house. And so it's very easy for me to simply use that same system an appropriate amount of time before an election to send out a notification for, hey, if you haven't registered to vote yet, here it is. So I am a big fan of that electronic notification, and it is easy, and that is scalable. It would take one push notification to get to every tenant. So Minneapolis Elections has been a wonderful partner in supporting me in this new endeavor. They created very simple, accessible information. The city let me know where that was. The Secretary of State's website is also easily accessible. And so having that piece there that this is what I need as a landlord when I go to the site and I look, I just download that and print that, has been, that support has been critical to making this easy for me to comply with.
Thank you, Ms. Flissran. Just a reminder, we're coming up on 7 o'clock, which was the time we're scheduled. We will run longer than 7 o'clock, so I just want to let folks know that we will be here tonight until we are done. So if testifiers could try to hold their comments to between 2 and 3 minutes, it will help us get through not just this bill, but other bills as well. Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Okay, move on to your next testifier.
It's just her.
Okay, I have a couple other individuals on the list. Loner Blue. Cecil Smith, if you could please come forward. Yeah, only if you're nice. Yeah, and you each don't get 3 minutes. If you could confine yourself, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is John Reynolds with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. With me is Cecil Smith, of Cornerstone Properties. The Multi-Housing Association is a group of 2,000 property owners, managers, builders, across the state of Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Gomez for taking the time to speak with me yesterday. I appreciate you keeping an open ear. Members, in your packets is a memo explaining our opposition in greater detail. I'll just briefly hit some of the high points, the first of which is this is an obligation that is unrelated to the business of managing and maintaining rental property, and as has been discussed, it will require additional resources or diversion of resources at a time when the cost of maintaining and managing property is already fairly high, and it does so under threat of a not insignificant penalty. I don't know what the monetary penalty is for a petty misdemeanor in the civil context. Certainly in the criminal context, it's up to $300. The second point I'll make briefly again is that we think that this is largely, to the extent that there's an issue, we think it's largely covered under existing processes. So if you fill out a change of address form with the United States Postal Service when you move from apartment to apartment, as I have many times, that information is automatically sent to the Secretary of State and your voter registration is updated. The same is true if you have a driver's license and you update that, as you're legally obligated to do within 30 days of relocating. That information is automatically shared with the Secretary of State's office. And then the last point we'll make just very briefly is that it's just not clear why this would be an effective point of contact. I guess the likely time at which this would be shared is when you're signing a lease or when you're moving in, neither of which days strike me as moments when you might have voter registration on your mind. And we also believe that it may sow confusion between the landlord and the tenant. And I'll leave the rest of the comments to Mr. Smith.
Mr. Smith, if you could state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Cecil Smith. I'm a owner and operator of Cornerstone Property Professionals. We own and manage apartment buildings in Minneapolis. I'm the former past board chair of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. I was involved in the opposition to the measure in Minneapolis where it was first introduced. And that was for many reasons, which Mr. Reynolds has outlined, some of them, but especially on philosophical grounds. Voter registration is a noble endeavor. We all should be proud of our efforts in the state of voter registration. But the precedent here is asking property owners to engage in an activity that has no nexus with the management of their properties, the health, life, safety, and compliance with providing housing. And this is a dangerous precedent because where does it end? One of the scenarios that I brought up for the city was, you know, are we going to now start asking our licensed taxi drivers to provide chemical dependency treatment information to their intoxicated passengers? When we ask licensed operators to engage in activities outside the nexus of their function, that is a very slippery slope where we become an agent of the government. And if this was a priority, then why is it that this voter registration information is not being sent to every household where there is not a registered voter? The irony of this is we provide this information to our residents at our lease signing, and we actually get assigned, we include in the lease a signed affidavit by the resident that they have received this information because we are subject to license revocation in Minneapolis if we do not comply, which adds another piece of paper into the process, and every single leaseholder has this. And then the irony was, I moved house this year and I provided a change of address. I didn't need to take one of my voter registration packets off the shelf that I have to give to one of my residents. My new polling place was sent to me through Minneapolis elections, and I knew exactly where to vote, and my registration was moved. So I urge opposition to this. It's unnecessary.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Any questions from committee members? Okay, seeing none. Are there any other individuals who would like to testify on behalf of against House File 979? Seeing none, House 979 will be laid over for inclusion.
We're not going to take questions on the bill from members.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Sure.
That's okay. Thank
yeah.
you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Before we lay it over, we will.
And I realize my comments will be very brief. I do have a professional background in the topic matter for the committee. And for those of you who have the bill in front of you, Statute 5.04B182. Is the requirement under the state of Minnesota that the Attorney General's office track, tabulate, coordinate, and make available to landlords and tenants alike information about provisions that are rights and responsibilities of landlords and tenants under Minnesota state law. I won't bore you with all the details, but it's things about security deposits, deducts, what happens if the units are not habitable. Representative Gomez, is it your intention to include that information, that the information that's in this bill, in that document that the Attorney General's office generates, or is this going to be a separate set of documents that will have to be generated and disseminated to individuals?
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll, for the question. No, this is it directs the Secretary of State to prepare the written materials and that they be posted and available for download from the Secretary of State's website. So it would be separate.
Okay.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gomez, thank you for the answer. One of the things, I guess, to just my final comments on this is, in a real estate transaction, when someone's buying, most times, and it's not required by law, closers will put a packet together. The real estate professionals that are involved, whether they be representing buyer or seller, typically want to make sure that such things as applications for homestead credit for a home that someone might be purchasing would be included in their takeaway packet, as well as voter registration information. I think by association, many of the landlords who belong to professional associations, they want to do these kinds of things, perhaps include information about how to apply for renter's credit, and it sets them apart from their competitors without having to put a legal burden out there for them to follow. And my experiences have been those who want to set themselves apart and build a good working relationship with their tenants do want to do those kinds of things, and if you will, have a competitive edge that the law doesn't require them to do over they're doing to bring the rest of the pack to them when they're trying to set themselves apart. So just some things maybe you want to consider as this bill continues to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Any other members have any other questions? Seeing no other questions, House File 979 will be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Gomez.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Okay, the last bill before us is House File 983, Representative Elkins, and he was so kind, even though I'm not going to be hardcore of bringing treats, as this is his first time presenting a bill before us.
That's late.
So we're getting dessert before dinner.
Is this backwards, Ben, Mr. Chair? We'll start with dessert, and I'll be
for it. Hey, I have a Representative Driscoll, I have a theory that you should always eat dessert first. Representative Elkins, if you could present your bill and speak to it. And I believe we do have one amendment, and I think we will move to that amendment prior to testimony of individuals.
Okay.
But after you get to speak to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill basically, I should say right now, charter cities in the state have the authority under existing state law to adopt ranked choice voting in their municipal elections. This bill would grant the same authority to other units of local government, including statutory cities, counties, townships, and school boards as well. In addition, the bill standardizes the procedures to be used in ranked choice voting to streamline them and make them easier for cities or other local governments who choose to adopt ranked choice voting to implement them. Personally, this is something that I've been a fan of for a long time as a local government official for 9 years in the city of Bloomington. Some of the advantages to a local government adopting this form of election would be that you would save the expense of holding low turnout primary elections. I know in Bloomington we have our elections, municipal elections, in odd years. It's common to have a turnout of no more than 5%, and weird things can happen in a primary with a 5% turnout. So this would eliminate the need for local governments to have those kind of low turnout primaries. It helps, removes the incentive to engage in negative campaigning. You don't want to, in a ranked choice election, alienate potential voters who whose first choice is another candidate, but you want them to vote for you for the second choice. It eliminates the incentive to engage in what's sometimes called the strategic voting or worrying about the wasted vote syndrome, where you vote for the least bad candidate who you think has a chance to be elected rather than the candidate that you would really prefer if you had your druthers, just in an effort to avoid seeing the election of wasting your vote and seeing the election of what you would consider to be the most bad candidate. And finally, if you're, as is often the case for statutory cities or school boards, have multi-seat elections with many candidates running for more than one seat,
It also eliminates the incentive to engage in what's called bullet balloting, where you only vote for one candidate out of many in order to improve the chances of that one candidate getting at least one of the available slots. So I have the state's leading expert, Jeannie Massey, sitting next to me. So members have of questions. The bill is very carefully crafted. It's very comprehensive, very well written. And I'm sure that between Jeannie and I, will be able to answer just about any questions committee members might have.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Elkins. And before we move on to that, we do have a DE1 amendment that's being offered.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually would like to hold off on the DE amendment if we can, because I would actually like to evaluate the bill before offering that amendment.
Okay. Thank you. Representative New, and we will now move on to testimony. As a reminder, I will ask testifiers to try to keep their comments between 2 and 3 minutes, which may be tough, but we'll keep an eye on the clock, and if you seem to be going long, I will let you know. So welcome. Please state your name and your affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and good evening. My name is Jean Massey, and I am the Executive Director of Fair Vote Minnesota. We are a statewide nonprofit and nonpartisan organization that promotes electoral systems that are more competitive and representative. I'm also an election judge. I've spoken with thousands of Minnesotans about ranked choice voting and how it can improve local elections, making them more efficient with outcomes reflecting broad support for winning candidates. During the past few years, interest in ranked choice voting has expanded dramatically across our state. Local officials and voters in many parts of the state are reaching out to us to learn how to get ranked choice voting adopted in their cities. Many of them are inspired by the success of RCV in Minneapolis and St. Paul and the recent adoption of RCV in St. Louis Park, and they're asking, why not here? Cities like Rochester, Red Wing, Bloomington, Minnetonka, New Ulms, Hopkins are all at different stages of exploring the system, and many others wish to consider adopting the system but cannot because they do not have the home rule authority that these other cities do. This bill would provide them with that opportunity. I'm here tonight to provide you with firsthand knowledge of Fair Vote Minnesota's experience with helping to implement ranked choice voting at the municipal level in Minnesota's two largest cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul, since 2009. So it's been in use for about 10 years. Since that time, more than 325,000 ranked ballots have been cast to determine winners in 77 municipal races. In 2017, the system was used to elect mayors in both cities and several city council members and additional offices in Minneapolis. In highly competitive races with multiple candidates, voters proved their competency with the process. Nearly 90% of the voters ranked their ballots. The effective ballot rate was 99.96%. That's pretty astonishing and something to celebrate regardless of the voting system used. RCV is widely credited with fostering more civil campaigns and increasing voter turnout as well. As to concerns about voter confusion, which we often hear, more than 90% of polled voters in Minneapolis and about 85% in St. Paul said that RCV was simple to use. And two-thirds of the respondents expressed a strong preference to keep the new system. These figures are not unique to Minneapolis or St. Paul. In fact, a similar positive experience with ranked ballots has been consistently demonstrated in cities across the country, as well as several states where ranked choice voting is used for military and overseas voters. In fact, by requiring voters to show up only once to the polls and allowing them to genuinely rank their preferences on the ballot, RCV simplifies voting for voters, especially older voters, and those who work or have children and find it difficult to turn out for two elections. RCV simply combines the nonpartisan primary and the general election. I'm just going to describe very briefly how that process works so there's no confusion about that. If a candidate receives a majority of first choices, that candidate wins. The goal is to make sure a candidate has a simple majority. If not, the rankings are used to conduct an instant runoff. The lowest vote getter is eliminated and the ballots cast for that candidate are reassigned to the remaining candidates based on those voters' second choices. This process continues until one candidate receives a simple majority. It works like the primary and general election, but in a single higher turnout election, and saves the expense and the time of conducting that extra election. It should also be noted that this process for Minneapolis, the first city to use RCV in Minnesota, has been neither burdensome nor chaotic for election administrators, candidates, or voters. Starting in May in 2009, it took the city less than 6 months to fully implement the new system. Implementation was actually delayed until late spring that year because of a legal challenge, which went all the way to the Minnesota Supreme Court. The court ruled unanimously in early May 2009 in favor of RCV, and it upheld the principle of one person, one vote, giving Minneapolis the green light to proceed. Contrary to concerns about implementation of the system, the process has gone very smoothly. To be certain, election officials had concerns going into the process, but those worries were quickly put to rest once the first RCV election was successfully implemented. We urge the committee to take into consideration the data demonstrating voter competence with the RCV system and the preference for the system, as well as the data showing successful administrative experience with ranked choice voting. Thank you for this opportunity, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Massey. And we're going to wait till all of the testifiers, in order to try to get through all of the testifiers, and then we'll have questions for members. So next on the list, I have Councilmember Linnea Fonsan.
She's here, and I do have one letter here from.
Okay, if you could get that to the page, you can actually get that passed out. And just so folks know, that was about 5 minutes. So because it was you, we let you go five. we will try to hold your comments again to 2 or 3 minutes. Please state your name and your affiliation and for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Chair Dean, members of the committee, my name is Linnea Palmisano, and I'm a Minneapolis City Council member. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to the importance of RCV. As you know, our city charter was amended by a referendum. It was actually a pretty popular referendum, over 60%, to establish RCV elections in Minneapolis. We had a work group planned for the first RCV in 2009. I've run twice as a candidate under ranked choice voting, and it was a more civil, inclusive process than I've seen in the past. While I haven't always been a fan of ranked choice voting, it truly contributed to my decision to run for office. Being new to this, all I knew about it was a 3-minute video that I had voted for in a previous election. And I would say that instead of in non-RCV elections where you carve out your winning space and you spend time on those that fit that space, unfortunately, that older model dilutes other voices. The 2017 election was our third time with ranked choice voting in Minneapolis, so how's it going and what have we learned? After each election, our city clerk analyzed the process to identify problems and develop solutions. Problems it identified included lack of voting, lack of turnout, voting errors, and delays in results. But none of these persisted, and in fact, with RCV, we've increased voter turnout substantially, up to 42% compared to a 15% national average in municipal elections. We have participation by a more diverse electorate. We know that under this RCV model. We're in a better place taking office because of how ranked choice voting plays out. You speak to everyone multiple times. I think that you really feel the charge to be more representative of the collective voice of the community under ranked choice voting. Mr. Chairman, we think ranked choice voting works in Minneapolis, and I'm happy to answer any questions. I think you said you'll wait till the end.
Council member, if you could hang around. I think hopefully we can get through all the testimonies in about 20 minutes or so, and if we have questions from members, we'll call you back at that time. Thank you. Next on the list, I have Evan Brown.
Evan was a victim of the weather and didn't make it up here.
Okay, so do we have a replacement for Evan Brown, Representative Elkins?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
That's fine. Commissioner Malechnik was here. He may have had.
He's still here. If you could come forward, Commissioner, and state your name for the record, your affiliation, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Randy Maluchnik. I'm the chair of the Carver County Board of Commissioners. I think I get this done real quick for you, Mr. Chairman. Today I'm testifying in support of House File 983. The 87 Minnesota counties, as well as our cities, townships, in the state of Minnesota, hold nonpartisan elections to elect our local public officials. A primary, as you know, in August, and a general election in November. Many times a primary attracts so few voters that my constituents have questioned why we even bother to hold them. What's the point, they have said to me. The case in point, in the last election in 2018, Carver County had one competitive commissioner race, excuse me, with five candidates running in the primary. Fewer than 2,400 voters cast a ballot in that primary race. In contrast, nearly 9,000 voters cast a ballot in the November race, nearly four times more voters. The low turnout primary in August does not always represent the spectrum of voters in an election. Commissioners, mayors, councilmen, and township supervisors often hold their seats for long periods of time. In their positions, they greatly impact the daily lives of the people in their jurisdictions. It's important that as many voters as possible weigh in on the decision on who represents them. Ranked choice voting is a possible common sense solution to the problem of low voter turnout. In effect, it would allow local government to consolidate two elections into one and result in winners with majority support in a single decisive election in November when the turnout is higher. It's more efficient and could possibly boost voter participation. At present, we don't have the option to adopt this system. The bill would allow local government the opportunity to explore ranked choice voting. Whether or not the system makes sense for the local government, they can make that decision for themselves. I don't know, and be honest, that Carver County as a body would ever decide to adopt ranked choice voting or not, but I think it's important that local government be given the opportunity to consider it. It's just another tool in a toolbox for local government. I urge you to support this measure, which would allow local jurisdictions the opportunity to innovate and improve their local electoral process, with cities like Minneapolis, St. Paul, and St. Louis Park already putting the blueprint for ranked choice voting in place. It should be straightforward, low-cost, effective use for other local governments to implement the system if that local government decides that it's what will work best for that local government. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. Actually, since a representative from your county has a very brief question, I'm going to break my guidelines and let him
Chairman,
ask.
Mr. Chairman, I anticipated that would happen.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Maluchnik, you introduced yourself as the chair of the Carver County Board, and I just want to clarify, because I haven't spoken to the other commissioners, but are you speaking on behalf of the Board of Commissioners or more on your own, and you happen to be the chair of the Board of Commissioners?
Mr. Maluchnik.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Nash. I'm absolutely testifying on my own accord.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Maluchnik and I are friends, but we just shone a little light on that. But I just wanted to clarify that for the record. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nash, thank you.
Yes. Yeah. We'll now move on to Tom Bennett.
Unless he's out in the hall somewhere. I haven't seen him.
Well, so we will try to locate Mr. Yeah. Bennett. In the meantime, we'll call up Ken Hosager. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is Kent Horsager. I grew up on a farm in north central Minnesota in Wadena County and attended the University of Minnesota studying agriculture economics, and currently reside in St. Anthony Village in the metro area. I spent my entire career involved in marketing and trading agriculture products. I became a member of the Minneapolis Grain Exchange about three decades ago and subsequently served as chairman of the board of directors and also as CEO of the Minneapolis Grain Exchange during a period of major innovation when we helped advance electronic trading so that producers of ag products, such were traded on the Minneapolis Grain Exchange, could access the markets in Minneapolis directly from their farm. I also served on the board of directors of the National Futures Association and the National Grain Trade Council, and have been approved as a served as a witness, expert witness testifying in the areas of futures, markets, and economics. In Minnesota, I've been involved in a number of nonprofit organizations and have served as chairman of the University of Minnesota Alumni Association, which, through its graduates and its alumni, touches every single county in Minnesota. These experiences have given me a great view to see how important innovation has been to our entire state. As an example, when I was growing up in Wadena County, we could expect our farm to produce about 75 bushels of corn per acre. Through various technology and agronomic innovations, that same farm now can produce 175 bushels per acre, which demonstrates the idea of continuous improvement. I recently became aware of this initiative to provide local governments the right and method to implement ranked choice voting, and immediately saw the value of this innovation in our election system. And similar to other innovations that I have witnessed that have helped keep our state competitive, this is another opportunity to improve our system. So in my view, I hope you consider approving this bill for a couple reasons. One is the principle of local choice. The bill corrects a fairness issue whereby statutory municipalities like the one where I grew up, Verndale, and the one where I currently reside, St. Anthony Village, are not afforded the opportunities to decide on ranked choice voting locally, which is not the case for charter cities, which already can make that choice. Secondly, the democratic principle of majority. If you approve local options bill, then local governments can choose this innovation and allow for the electorate to always have achieved a majority, not plurality, winner in their local offices, which, in my view, should positively affect the governance process. And finally, the economic principle. Ranked choice voting can help election processes be more efficient, which means saving time and money. So for those reasons, local choice, government by majority, and economic benefits, I advocate for supporting this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hosager. And if you could hang around, we may have some questions. Hopefully it will be within the next 10 minutes or so. Is Tom Bennett, have we located Tom Bennett?
He's not here. There is a letter from Mr. Bennett that should be in the package.
Okay.
Mr. Bennett is a school board member in Bloomington, and his letter testifies to, I believe, about the, what the impact would be on a local school board election.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. You have a letter if you would like to look at, and we will move on to Kim Nelson. Please state your name and affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Good evening. My name is Kim Nelson, and I bring 30 years of experience with General Mills with me this evening, and I'm here to share a business perspective on ranked choice voting. Many business leaders are alarmed at the increasing inability of our political system to produce lasting bipartisan solutions to the major issues that are really important to the advancement of our state and our nation. Shutdowns and threats of shutdowns are not only afflicting our national government, but they've become routine even here in Minnesota. They're extremely disruptive to business, many of which have government contracts, and you know, we have a deeply integrated economy, so they're problematic. Businesses plan and make investments on long time horizons, and it's inefficient, impractical, and costly to invest in compliance and legislation only to see policies upended and reversed a few years after power changes hands. Appropriately negotiated bipartisan legislation is essential to produce the kind of certainty and economic stability that businesses need for planning. The 19 Fortune 500 companies headquartered here in Minnesota depend on being able to attract and retain employees in our state. We need our elected officials to address the many complex challenges that afflict us today. These are issues that must be addressed to ensure the future prosperity of our state, transportation, healthcare, education, community safety, and so forth. The kind of acrimonious gridlock that we frequently observe is not helpful and does not serve the people of Minnesota. Many business leaders are attracted to ranked choice voting because it simplifies our electoral system and it incentivizes more candidates to appeal to a broader swath of constituents. This is a great way to reduce the toxic polarization that we're seeing and promote more positive campaigns actually focused on issues rather than smearing opponents. Many of us have observed from afar the adoption of ranked choice voting in Minneapolis, St. Paul, St. Louis, and even across the nation, and concluded that it is a simple, effective step that we can take to change our current trajectory. I would urge you to adopt this bill to allow other jurisdictions in Minnesota to be able to choose this electoral reform if they see fit. Local control and the belief that local jurisdictions know what's best for them is foundational to Minnesota values. This bill upholds those values and gives these jurisdictions tools they need to decide for themselves how to elect their local leaders. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. We'll now move on to Mark Gorlick. Please state your name for the record, your affiliation, if you're representing anybody versus yourself.
Great.
And proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Gorlick. I'm the president and CEO of Children's Minnesota. And I am speaking as not as a representative of the hospital, but as a leader of a large local business organization. I think it's hardly any secret that civic engagement and trust in public institutions in general and government in particular are at probably historic lows. But the effect that this has on business and the economy may not be as obvious. A 2013 report from the National Center on Citizenship, funded by the nonpartisan Knight Foundation, summarized studies that show links between civic engagement on the one hand and economic resilience on the other, including lower unemployment and less adverse economic impact during the Great Recession, as well as links between civic engagement and other measures of community health, such as public school performance, net in-migration of residents, and infrastructure investment. In short, civic engagement and voter participation are good for democracy, good for the community, and good for business. Despite the best efforts of companies and organizations such as ours, citizens remain disconnected. Ranked choice voting addresses many of the root causes of disengagement and apathy. First, as you've heard, it promotes greater turnout by making it easy, only asking voters to come out on one occasion versus two or three separate times. And as a business leader, I appreciate the lower cost and efficiency of this approach, not only lower cost to the state and therefore to the taxpayers, but also less disruption among my 5,500 employees who are seeking to exercise their democratic rights. Second, it ensures the winner has at least some level of support from the majority of voters. Third, it widens the pool of voices heard during the campaign and makes the focus more on issues. And finally, it decreases polarization and negative campaigning. I got to witness the benefit of ranked choice voting firsthand when I moved from Milwaukee to Minneapolis in 2017. If we can leave aside for a moment the whole Packer-Viking thing, Wisconsin and Minnesota are actually culturally and politically quite similar. But the municipal elections that I participated in Minneapolis in 2017 were nothing like the hyper-polarized, corrosive electoral environment I experienced in Milwaukee just the year before. I believe that difference is better, both from my perspective as a concerned citizen and as the leader of a large local business. In fact, I believe that ranked choice voting is the thing that may help save our political system. So I urge you to support the local options bill, which would allow all jurisdictions in Minnesota to choose, if they wish, to experience the benefits of ranked choice voting, as Minneapolis, St. Paul, St. Louis Park, and several others have already done. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gorlick, and I will not ask you who you voted for in the city of Minneapolis election. I will speak to it at some point as we discuss this evening. Now, we're getting close to 7:30. I know there are a lot of members of the public here, so I'm going to allow 2 minutes for two members of the public to speak if they'd like to speak, and it'll be the first couple of hands I see. Okay, so you two get to go. So come on, step forward, state your name, and you have 2 minutes to speak to this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representatives. My name is Andrew Schuler. I'm a resident of Golden Valley, and I just want to point out a statistic. In 2013, we had about 9 candidates running, and 62% of the voters voted for losing candidates, and that's very wrong. So I think this is an easy way to fix that solution. It's not my favorite voting system, but it's better than what we have now. So I'm all for it. Thank you.
Thank you. And ma'am, if you could come forward. And I'll give you a little bit of his time, so you have 2.5 minutes. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Diane Steen-Hinderly, and I'm from St. Louis Park and just recently experienced it was like a school year long of our intense campaign to get RCV going out there. And thank you for letting us speak. I'm glad to talk with you, committee members. My first cousin, our dads were brothers, was Dr. Lynn Arthur Steen, who was the longtime chair of the mathematics department down at St. Olaf, and that was also my alma mater. And he knew that his little cousin was interested in RCV, so maybe about 10 years ago, he on his own did a study of ranked choice voting, and one of my visits thereafter down to Northfield, I was able to talk to him about it, and he said, well, there's absolutely nothing wrong with ranked choice voting, so what's all the fuss? And because there has been resistance. It's been quite a few years that we've had to struggle with this, even though it seems common sense on the surface, but somehow it's treated controversially. And so when I got back to St. Louis Park, I was curious about when this is taught in school, this concept of ranking. So I called my son's elementary school. They're long out of it. The expert that I was referred to said, well, we don't have to teach it at all. The kids come to kindergarten already knowing how to rank many things mathematically, and they learn it in preschool. And so, and this was just very enlightening to me. And I know that for most government documents, especially what is transmitted to the citizenry, like in elections, information, instructions, it's geared to an eighth grade level. The government assumes that voters coming will be able to handle English at an eighth grade level, and there always are judges that are able to help out people. And we've done language translations. We really try. But it's all geared towards eventually having people operate at an eighth grade level of reading. And so I don't see why we can't just easily incorporate preschool level math into our voting system. So this erroneous meme that things are confusing with ranked choice is just because we haven't done it. But people will right away say, oh, it was just easy. You know, I've seen my husband and I have volunteered at the most diverse precincts in Minneapolis, and it's not seen as confusing by all these people. So I'll close just by saying I think of the 3 points of it ensures the majority rule much better than our current system, majority and winners, producing majority rule. It's much better for civility, and it produces more diversity among both the candidates and the servicing of our increasingly diverse population. So thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. And we are going to open up for two-minute testimony from the overflow room, and Representative Committee Member Bernardi is going over there, so I'm guessing that within a few seconds we will see some people coming in, or just Representative Bernardi, and we will go from there. We're all, nobody wants to, so that's, nobody wants to leave. So what I'll do now is I will open it up to committee member questions, and just to give us a sense of, I'd still like to be out of here by 7:45, so if your questions might be able to fit within that period, that would be great. But first, Representative New, are you at a place where you would like to or choose not to offer the amendment?
I would actually really like to ask some questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I have Ms. Massey rejoin me here in case the questions get detailed?
Absolutely, you can. Questions? Representative, you get to start.
Excellent. Where to start? Thank you. Thank you, Chair Dean. I apologize, but I do hope, Mr. Chair, that you will allow us to thoroughly vet the bill. I think this really is a fundamental change to how we do elections across the state. And so I feel like I'm already feeling a little squeezed on time, but I've got a lot of questions, and I've spent a lot of time digging into the bill. So I do hope that you'll give us some time to go over these things. And I suppose maybe the best way to do this is I have my own copy of the bill that I've marked up. So perhaps I will go through this and ask questions as we go. I guess, you know, let's start with subdivision 2 on page 4.2 to 5.2, mixed election ballot methods. And I guess I would ask Representative Elkins, do you know, have there been any mixed ballot elections in Minnesota yet?
Representative Elkins.
Refer to Ms. Massey on that.
Ms. Massey.
Representative New, in most cities across the country, ranked choice voting is combined with state and federal election years and mixed ballots. So it is happening elsewhere, but not yet here in Minnesota, because the only use has been in Minneapolis and St. Paul, which have odd year municipal races. So this particular part of the bill allows for flexibility in ballot design to allow for that more simply. Right now, I'll just point out that there are different kinds of elections in state and federal election years for school board and for city council, and vote for up to three for at large, or vote for just one in a Senate seat. So there are different kinds of elections, but adding a ranked component would add a different layer of design requirements. So this bill would simply allow for that flexibility.
Representative New.
Thank you. And to your point, that currently these are off-year elections, you know, there were many comments about voter turnout being increased only once. Is there a reason, Representative Elkins, that you have not worked into a bill a requirement to hold elections on even year general election days? Because certainly if our goal is voter turnout, that is certainly the best mechanism to increase voter turnout.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Each city has that choice, and some cities choose to hold their elections in even years, and some cities choose to hold them in odd years. There are advantages and disadvantages, but you know, that's another example of each local jurisdiction making its own choices in that regard.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. And Representative Elkins, on line 4.26, 4.27, it says that a jurisdiction may use ballots compatible with alphanumeric character recognition voting equipment. And I guess my question is, I assume, and maybe inaccurately, that there are jurisdictions where this kind of equipment is currently being used. And I guess, you know, when, you know, I mean, boy, even just voice to text doesn't do real well. I guess I would be interested in knowing if there are statistics available on the accuracy of this kind of voting equipment.
Representative Elkins?
Yeah, I'll defer to Ms. Massey on that one.
Ms. Massey.
Sure.
The purpose of this language in the bill is to allow for the flexibility depending on the direction of where voting equipment actually goes. There is not voting equipment in place in Minnesota, or to my knowledge, anywhere else in the United States that reads an alphanumeric manner. So right now, the way that this would be applied would be with the current voting equipment. It simply provides for the flexibility, not knowing the direction of where voting equipment could go, because that technological possibility is certainly there.
Mm-hmm. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Massey. So that actually, I mean, there's actually been significant discussions around voting machines, and that's something we certainly don't take lightly, I think, in Minnesota. So I guess I would be pretty concerned about putting into statute the ability to purchase that equipment without any statistical analysis, any real data about what might be available in the future, I would suggest that may be a concern. But let me go on to another question. In line 4.22, it says, it's talking about the ballot format, and it says that a ballot must include instructions to voters that clearly indicate how to mark the ballot. And I'm wondering, Representative Elkins, do you have language for that? That seems quite subjective. That I don't know what clearly means, clearly to who. I mean, we've heard some phrasing come up that I feel like is not necessarily clear. So I wonder if you know what that language would be and how that language would be determined.
Yeah, I think
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there are a variety of ways to do that, which is why the language isn't more specific than that. Anything to add?
No, it simply really is consistent with the way the statute now reads to ensure that as much guidance to voters as possible is provided on the ballot itself for instructions.
Representative.
Mr. Chair and Representative Elkins, mm-hmm. I don't see it spelled out, and perhaps it is elsewhere in statute and not noted here, mm-hmm. but it does not indicate how that language would be determined. Who's creating that language, what the guidelines are for that. So I guess I am wondering where specifically that language would come from.
Jean, you have
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Ms. Mass.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, the way the ordinance reads right now in jurisdictions that do it allows for the head election official to establish those rules and guidelines, and that's what this particular component of the statute would also allow for.
So, Ms. Massey, just to be clarified, this isn't prescriptive, it's instructive and allows the local elected officials to choose the language that would indicate how to mark the ballot.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Newman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would ask, can you let me know where that language is, Representative Elkins or Ms. Massey? I don't see the language, so I'm just wondering where that language is. And perhaps nonpartisan staff would be more appropriate to answer that question. Or perhaps you know, sir.
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Gehring may
Mr.
know.
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative New, so on page 5, lines 5.3 to 5.5, provides that the chief election official in each jurisdiction provides administrative rules for ballot format, which would include
that. Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Gehring. That was helpful. Okay, so my next question is lines 4.15 and 4.16. It says the chief election shall notify the Secretary of State and, if applicable, the county auditor. And I guess my question is, Representative Elkins, when would the county auditor not be involved in this as they oversee the elections in the county? When would the county auditor not receive that information?
Representative Elkins.
Mr. Chair, I think that that's information that they would normally receive in the course of business under existing law. It's just being reiterated here.
Thank you. Representative Liu.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is there a reason that then in line 4.15, the language, if applicable, so I assume that's just superfluous then? It's always applicable? Is that what you're indicating, Representative Elkins?
Representative Elkins.
Mr. Chair, I suspect that Mr. Gehring might know the answer to this question as well.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, so I think the reason for the if applicable here is that this bill does authorize counties also to use ranked choice voting, and so in that case, the county auditor would be the one that's adopting all these procedures. So if applicable means if the county auditor doesn't already know, like by virtue of that person's work, that they're doing ranked choice voting, then they'll get the notice.
Representative New.
So, Mr. Gehring, it would only apply then specifically to county elections that use ranked choice voting?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, so I think the language here is intended to require the notice of the county auditor if the county auditor doesn't already know, because the county is conducting ranked choice voting. So the notice applies all the time, but in some cases, if the county is the jurisdiction that's doing ranked choice voting, the county auditor is running that election, so the county auditor doesn't need to provide a notice for herself that she's conducting it. So I think that's the reason for that language.
Okay, so it's perhaps a bit superfluous, because it would always be the case that they would... Okay, great, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gearing. Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So let's move on to page 6. And this is where I don't mean to mince words, but I'm actually a little, you know, we mentioned that this is very simple math that even a third grader could do. Listen, I did pretty well in calculus in my day. I'm a bit of a mathematician, and I really had to put some thought into this. This really involves a pretty significant amount of order of operations and whatnot. So I guess in calculating these things, I really had to think this through. And like I said, I'm no slump when it comes to math. So I've got some questions on page 6 and how this is all playing out. Number one, my first question would be, in lines, let's see here, 6.1, I apologize, I've got all kinds of notes, so I can't see the numbers very well, 6.13 to 6.17, it talks, it says specifically, after any surplus votes are calculated but not yet transferred, all candidates for whom it is mathematically impossible to be elected must be defeated by batch elimination. Okay, I understand how they move out as a batch. Votes for the defeated candidates must be transferred to each ballot's next ranking, and it goes on. Why would the surplus votes not also be transferred at that time? Representative Elkins.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, this whole section, mm-hmm. okay, as you've observed, is got to be very precise so that it could be programmed into a computer. The language reflects the way, it's really kind of reverse engineered. It reflects the way the computers have been programmed in order to correctly tabulate the vote. So for a lay person, this is hard to read. But for a computer programmer, it's the language. And Representative Nash might want to weigh in on that as well. But
well, I'm not a programmer. I don't want to do that.
Well,
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is actually more than a technical IT kind of question. This is a question of, so in line 6.11, it talks about the surplus votes. And in 6.13, it says that after any surplus votes are calculated but not yet transferred, then the batch elimination happens, and then the votes for the defeated candidates are transferred, but the surplus votes are not transferred. So that's not an IT question. That's a principle going into this calculation. So I guess my question to you, Representative Elkins, is why was that decision made?
So maybe we could
actually,
sit, Mr. Chair.
Representative Elkins, I could actually speak to this.
Great.
Because I paid really close attention. in a race that, say, you have 16 candidates, mm-hmm. And after the first set of balloting, you're able to mathematically determine that 11 of those candidates have no mathematical possibility, mm-hmm. then they are considered surplus votes and are transferred as defeated votes as a whole, not individually. Because if you go on to 4 and you go on to 5, for those individuals who are not mathematically unable to move forward because mathematically they're in essence defeated, they get transferred at one time. And correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Massey.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, I think I understand the detail that you're looking at. Representative Dean is correct in that you don't want to transfer any votes to candidates who are going to be mathematically eliminated, so that step happens first. And then once that does, and this particular part of these rules apply to the multi-seat elections, not the single-seat elections, mm-hmm. where you have votes that are in excess of those needed to win also get transferred. They get transferred after that batch elimination happens because those candidates are mathematically impossible to win. If that answers your question.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Dean. I'm not sure that it does. I think that the language of the bill offers a different definition of surplus. It says very specifically in 2.13 that the surplus means the total number of votes cast for an elected candidate in excess of the threshold. So this would specifically apply to candidates who have already met the threshold and would be considered elected. Is that not correct?
Ms. Massey.
Representative. So I do want to just let members of the committee know that these particular rules have been tried and tested, and they're the best practice kind of rules that are used in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and elsewhere around the country. And again, this particular section that you are referring to refers to those races like the Minneapolis Park Board race where you're electing more than one at a time. You're electing up to three. So that once you set that threshold to win in a three-way race, that's 25%. If any candidate has votes beyond that 25%, that surplus is transferred proportionally. But again, the step of eliminating the candidates first who mathematically cannot win occurs because you don't want to transfer any votes to them because they mathematically cannot win.
Sure.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I think I understand that. My question is, I don't know that I've got an answer yet on the definition of a surplus vote. The surplus vote is specifically cast for an elected candidate in excess of the threshold. So I think the way I understood, Chair Dean, your explanation was that surplus vote applies to those who are removed via batch elimination. But, and it sounds like, Ms. Massey, you confirmed that, but I would suggest that the language of surplus exclusively applies to those in excess of the threshold. So it would actually be the opposite. It would not be those who have been eliminated via batch elimination. It would apply to those who have actually been elected and those surplus votes. Perhaps Mr. Gehring could clarify that.
Ms. Massey.
You're correct. I think there's some confusion about what that surplus definition means. In this particular part of the bill that you're referring to, the surplus is the additional votes over the threshold met by a candidate and then reallocatable based on that surplus value.
And this is only applicable in multi-seat.
That's correct.
Representative Elkins. Yes. Representative Neal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I would go back to my initial question. The initial question then was, why are those surplus votes not included in, why are those surplus votes not transferred before the next elimination is made? Why are only the votes for the defeated candidates transferred? It's because it says votes for the defeated candidates must be transferred to each ballot's next ranking continuing candidate, and the tabulation process reiterates beginning with clause 2. So you move the votes for the defeated candidates, and then you go back to clause 2 recalculating the surplus votes. So those surplus votes are not included at that point, and that's my question. Why are the surplus votes not included? The batch elimination votes are, the surplus votes are not.
Ms. Massey, and I think I have a possible answer too, but I'll let you go first.
Yeah, I think I can too.
Yeah, Representative New, the logic behind this is once you have candidates who are mathematically defeated, mm-hmm. those votes are reallocated to remaining candidates, and those are whole votes. They are defeated, they no longer are in contention. And then once that happens, then you reallocate any surplus votes before moving on to the next round.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. I think that the point is that the process of transferring the votes from the eliminated candidates may add to the surplus
of a candidate who's already over the thresholds. And then you've got additional surplus votes to allocate when you do the allocation of the surplus votes.
Representative New, it seems to have a little bit more clarity now?
Maybe a little. maybe a little. So let me ask about another scenario. I'll move on. I'm not sure that that's going to get any more clear than what that is. In line, let's see here. Okay, so in the next section, in four, it says the transfer value of each vote cast for an elected candidate must be transferred to the next continuing candidate on the ballot. Of the candidates whose vote totals reach or exceed the threshold, the candidate with the largest surplus is declared elected, and that candidate's surplus is transferred. So, Representative Elkins, does that mean immediately?
Representative Elkins. Or Ms. Massey.
I think the answer to that is yes, Mr. Chair.
So that happens immediately. So then my question is, so if you have two candidates then who meet the threshold, the highest candidate is now declared elected. So is that saying then that those surplus votes are immediately transferred? So am I to understand then that the next candidate who has actually met the threshold could still lose by those surplus votes being transferred, and then maybe the third place candidate, even though they haven't met the threshold yet, but the second candidate has met the threshold, that now that third place person could actually move ahead of that second place person because of those surplus votes?
That's to Representative Elkins.
Yeah.
I think I know the answer, but we'll go to Representative.
I think that's mathematically impossible, Mr. Chair. But if you have a different opinion.
Representative Elkins and Representative New, I believe if two candidates meet a threshold at a particular point, then actually both candidates are considered victorious, and you would then redistribute their surplus votes to put in place the remaining votes for other candidates who may actually then meet the threshold. So, if there was three or four seats and you had two candidates that met the required threshold, whether it was 25 or, I'm not going to get into the math right now. I took calculus too, but I cannot work an integral to save my life today. So once a candidate reaches that threshold, they then are deemed victorious, and then you move down to the next individuals. And we're getting about 25 minutes on your questions. So,
well, again, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the latitude, because really this, I think that I'm raising some pretty important questions that I would suggest don't have real clear answers. So I do think this is important. So I guess I would just point out that I don't think the language agrees with your assessment, Mr. Chair. I think the language very clearly indicates that the candidate with the largest surplus is declared elected, and then that candidate surplus is transferred immediately, as Representative Elkins indicated, which means that a third candidate then could immediately move to a higher ranking than the second one, even though they may have already reached the threshold. I think this order of things really is critical in this.
Sure. I'll have Ms. Massey address this, because you know, these models have been run and considered, and they probably actually have been in practice as well. So, Ms. Massey, if you could speak to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, that is correct. Mathematically, that's not possible, and Chair Dean is correct. If two people meet the threshold, those two candidates are automatically declared. What is being spoken to here in this description is the order in which those surplus transfers happen in order to continue to elect candidates. So if there are more than two candidates being elected, if there are three or four, then the person with the highest surplus
has those surplus transferred first, and then the process moves on.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Massey. I appreciate that clarification. I'm not sure the language of the bill actually offers that clarification, but I appreciate that. I guess two last questions.
Sure.
The next one would be, thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 7.71, it talks about total votes cast. And in the definitions, I did not see a definition for total votes cast.
Representative New, could you please state that line again?
Yes, 7.17. So it references total votes cast, and that is not outlined in the definitions. So my question on that is, total votes cast, does that mean total ballots cast? Does that mean total votes with, does each ranking equal a vote? How is the total votes cast calculated?
Mr. Chair, I suspect that's a question for Mr. Gehring, because those seem like terms of the art to me.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, so that term is consistent with the way the precinct summary statements are prepared right now for regular elections. So total votes cast reflects the total number of ballots that are put in the machine at the end of the night.
Ballots. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Then my last. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My last question regarding. I promised you I would only have two more. I guess. Mr. Chair, when it comes to recounts, I see a number of recounts available at the expense of a candidate. Are there any circumstances, Representative Elkins, under which there would be an automatic recount, like there would be in a standard election? And typically, automatic recounts are not paid for by the candidate. Typically, those costs are reimbursed. So are there any situations in which there would be just an automatic recount?
Representative Elkins.
Mr. Chair, I think that's addressed in 8.4 and 8.5, but I think Mr. Gehring could probably confirm that.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, yes, so this section 8, provides the same recount standards that apply to ordinary elections, but also apply to ranked choice voting elections. So we don't, under current law, actually have an automatic recount process anymore. So there is a process where if the difference in the votes between the candidates is within 0.5%, the state will pay for the recount, but it has to be requested by the candidates.
But that would still apply. Okay. I do appreciate the latitude, Mr. Chair. I guess at this point, I would suggest that I really do have concerns about the language of this bill. I don't feel like it's real clear even to the author. I think that there are a lot of question marks. And I also have concern that if we have confusion in this committee about how this plays out, I certainly have real concerns about how this plays out for the voters. And particularly, this is a piecemeal approach. This is saying that individual jurisdictions can do it the way they want, which is fine. You know, we've referenced Minneapolis quite a bit. And I remember when Minneapolis implemented ranked choice voting, and there was a great deal of education that went into that. And I think voters really were well educated and well prepared for that. My concern is, as different jurisdictions may pick this up, clearly we're a mobile society and people move a lot. And when we have folks who move from a traditional voting system to a system with ranked choice voting, and they've sort of moved in past that education period, I think that causes real concerns. I think that is confusing. Like I said, if we in this room have some confusion about the language, certainly I think the voters can have some confusion. I think that this is, I mean, again, we boast the highest voter turnout in the entire country, and that's something to be so proud of for us. I would suggest that elections and voting is really among the most sacred things we do in Minnesota. And this is something that I think voters deserve to understand. And for that reason, Mr. Chair, I would offer the DE amendment that would really put in place uniform elections across the state.
Thank you, Representative New. She has moved the DE1 amendment to your amendment, and then we will move to a vote after some questions or comments from members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I spoke to the amendment.
Okay.
Thank you. I would urge members to support the amendment.
Okay. We have the DE1 amendment before us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
The DE1 amendment is not adopted.
Mr. Chair, I believe it's your intention to lay this over in any case, so which gives me an opportunity to allay Representative New's concerns with the follow. But what I would say in closing is that actually this does standardize the method that would be used for ranked choice voting elections in any local jurisdiction that chooses of its own volition to do so, and that's one of the strengths of the bill, actually.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Just to note, this does not require any local jurisdiction to adopt ranked choice voting.
Any local jurisdictions to do it. It's entirely at the discretion of the local jurisdiction.
And before we lay this over, I'm just going to make a couple of quick
Mr.
comments.
Chair.
Yes, Representative.
I had indicated that I had questions myself as well.
I'm sorry. Please proceed with your questions.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative New asked some very valid questions that I'm not sure we got great answers to, and not trying to be contentious, but being contentious nonetheless. These are important things, Representative Elkins, and both you and I have served in municipal elected office. And I just had some comments that I think bear mentioning. We heard, I believe, from Ms. Nelson about this acrimonious gridlock and toxic polarization. I was mayor for two terms, city councilman for one term. I don't remember any toxic polarization concerning the elections. And I ran in a three-way race for my first term as mayor. It's pretty straightforward. Very straightforward. And I don't know, Representative Elkins, how this would have been germane to that race. We've got multiple people running for that race, and yet I was the winner. Mm-hmm. I just think that knowing the people that I represent, having voted in the way that they have, I just wonder what is the benefit to this, from your perspective, for cities that are, as I would be classified, I would imagine, by some that live more metro than I in the 7-county metro. I'm in outstate Minnesota, even though I'm in the 7-county metro. How is this going to benefit the people of Carver County or of Waconia or Norwood Young America or somewhere like that, where there may be multiple candidates, but how is this going to bear any impact on them when simply, as we have in the past, we just have the winner become the winner? So help me understand, and then, Mr. Chair, I do have a good number of other questions.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask you to keep your questions brief, and Representative Elkins, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Like yours, my experience in local government is that in nonpartisan local governments, people by and large are able to be to disagree without being disagreeable. That's not universally the case, and there are a number of cities within the metro area that where you could characterize the local elections as being extremely contentious, even school board elections. So that's not a universal case, even though it's a goal to be aspired to and a goal that most local governments actually meet.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'd love to know where this acrimonious gridlock and toxic polarization exists, and perhaps in the cities that aren't already using ranked choice voting. But that's another issue altogether. I guess some of the questions that I have also around line 9.14 and 9.15. You talk about errors, overvotes, skipped rankings, duplicate rankings in a ranked choice voting election. So if any of these things happen, then what? And you can use your testifier, since you've relied on her fairly heavily for some of the more technical aspects of that. What happens in these circumstances? How do you notify somebody regarding these following errors? Because you require in 9.14 that you notify voters of errors. How does that happen?
Representative Elkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What this provision, Section 12, is basically saying is, in this case, would be if you tried to feed a ballot through the machine that had one of these errors, they would spit it back out, and you send it back to the teller to get a new ballot.
Okay.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, it's another question. You've talked about voting machines that would need to be used that don't exist, right? The fair categorization that we've talked about earlier when...
No.
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, I will.
Ms. Massey.
Representative Nash, no, the language of the bill simply allows for that flexibility if voting machines have that technological capacity in the future. Right now, ranked choice voting works with the current machines used throughout most of Minnesota.
All right, I just wanted to clarify that.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're laying this over in an omnibus bill. In the interest of, obviously, you wishing to move along, I'll have a lot of other questions for you. You can accept some time. I echo what Representative New said with many of the issues around the mathematical computation requirements being unclear. I really don't think that it is particularly well spelled out. So I think this is a long way from being ready to become law. So
Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Elkins.
I think that the reason that that the language is hard to read is that it has to be spelled out in excruciating detail to be accurately programmed. I'm not a programmer either, but as Ms. Massey said, this algorithm has been implemented and is tried and true.
Well, Mr. Chair.
One more question, Representative.
Thanks. I will say that I've watched some of the Minneapolis results and other ranked choice voting results, and I don't know that it's as clear as you would indicate, and I know for a fact that there are sometimes days before people know that they have won. Is that an accurate depiction?
The very first election, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Elkins.
Yeah, that was because it had to be executed in a spreadsheet. Mm. Now we don't have to do that anymore.
Well, again, grave concerns with
Representative
with how
Nash.
You
go ahead and make a closing statement.
Thank
if you'd
you,
like to.
Chair Dean, for your consideration. I think this is just something that needs a tremendous amount of additional work. Obviously, Representative New went on for quite a while, and I'm not sure I heard answers that made me feel comfortable with this. I think that a good number of our colleagues around the Capitol are going to feel similarly. Mm-hmm. And something that is this profound, because this is a profound change, I think many of your testifiers have talked about the fact that this is a very large change. You do not want to get this wrong, so I would encourage you to continue working on it, because, again, very unclear for Representative New, Representative O'Driscoll, myself. I think that you'll find similar commentary on that same line. So. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, Representative New has
Mr.
one
Chair, part. You have 10 seconds.
Okay. 10 seconds, Representative
I would just encourage everyone to do the math, because if look at a scenario where there are five candidates for four offices, and indeed someone can be, that would put the numbers that somebody could receive 22 votes, the threshold would be 21. That could put votes at 22 votes, 21 votes, and 20 votes. The person with 22 would be elected. That surplus vote of one could go to the 20 vote, and now you've got a tie situation where that person who has met the threshold at 21 is now tied with a new person at 21, and it's a coin toss. So just putting that out there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative New, I don't believe that would happen if you had four of five members already meeting the threshold. Then they would be elected to those offices.
So,
and I understand that you have some concerns about the language here, and I'm sure we will continue to discuss this as this is going to be laid over. Before this bill gets laid over, I would just like to comment about a couple of the witnesses, Ms. Nelson and Mr. Gorlick. I believe that ranked choice voting does have an impact on campaigns. I participated in a campaign that involved many candidates, and ultimately we talked about issues up until the day before Election Day. And we actually talked about issues on Election Day, because if you can get a person to vote on Election Day, that's great too. You just can't be within 100 feet of the polls. It changes the tenor of how candidates conduct themselves. And I think it's wonderful that in your part of the state, the contention is pretty sparse. I would say that prior to ranked choice voting in the city of Minneapolis, following primary day, the only thing you heard about candidates was how bad they were, not about what their positions were. And I think that that's something that is threatening our democracy, and I think it's something that we as candidates, we can choose to move away from that. But unfortunately, the results show that negative campaigning has, it does work. And it doesn't work in the way that most people think it would work. It doesn't make it so people vote for you. What it does is it makes it so that people don't vote. And ultimately, what we encourage in Minnesota, and although we've talked a lot about having the highest voter turnout in the country, compared to other countries, our voter turnout is abysmal. So let's move beyond our borders when we think about our voter turnout in that context. I think there's a lot to be said about ranked choice voting and how issues are not only talked about, but how candidates begin to pay attention to what other candidates are saying. I was not successful in my election, but I know that I've been excited to see the individual who did win the election adopt a lot of the things that we talked about in our campaign that weren't necessarily a big driving point in their campaign. So I think that we can never forget that what this bill does, it does not require any jurisdiction to take up ranked choice voting. It just allows them the opportunity, if they want to actually do it. So this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion, and I want to thank members for your questions, sticking around. I want to thank testifiers, Representative Elkins, all of your testifiers, and all the members of public were here tonight, and this meeting is adjourned.